just my future, but the future generations. And so it's really important to kind of have that genuine approach to it, because it has very genuine and very direct and personal impacts. And it's taxing, right? And so, you know, I guess this is kind of more speaking to some of the other Native leaders or people who are doing, you know, Native folks who are doing a lot of great work, is that it's a lot. You know, you're putting your emotions, you're putting yourself on your sleeves and telling the world, this is who I am, this is what I'm about. And that, you know, continue to put up that fight as much as you can, because I think everyone has a breaking point, and it's a hard thing to do day in and day out. And so it's something that hopefully folks don't take, you know, for granted, because it's something that is very, it's a lot on the psyche, and you're continuing to have to prove yourself to the world. And so acknowledgement, as well as a huge shout out to the people who do that in the same way that I do, or what I try to do.
I think that's a beautiful note to leave this on. So Ryan Reed, thank you so much for all the work that you do, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Michael.
That is it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. Once again, my email is michael@coastrange.org. Drop me a line anytime, and please share this show with all your friends, all your communities. You can find links to the resources that we discussed in the show notes of the podcast or at our website, coastrange.org. And you can also look up Ryan Reed at firegencollab.org. Thank you so much for listening to Coast Range Radio. We will be back with new episodes very soon.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at kboo.fm.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7. on your FM dot.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got 4 requests for this thing already today. Strutting right there.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly, what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
Welcome to Labor Radio on KBOO Portland. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilliland.
Thank you so much for joining us. We would first just like to give a special thanks and shout out to the Labor Radio Podcast Network for hosting podcasted versions of our show each month. Be sure to check that out at laborradionetwork.org. And before we get started, I want to let you all know that KBOO has been on the air for 55 years, making us one of the oldest community radio stations in the country, and one of the longest standing media institutions here in Portland. And we've been able to maintain a commercial free volunteer powered resource for this community because of support from amazing people like you. In fact, actually 80% of the station's funding comes from the generosity of our members. So if you can, please, help us continue to serve this wonderful community by donating today. You can just go to kboo.fm/give. We here at Labor Radio thank you so much for your support. So now on to our discussion today. The first days of the new administration, the Trump administration, you know, we're basically a month into it now, and already it has been kind of disastrous for working people and the state of labor in this country, and honestly is kind of laying the groundwork for longer-term struggles that we'll have to deal with, like problems being laid now that are going to continue to bear fruit moving forward through the rest of, you know, our this generation and the next generation's working lives. Just right off the bat, major regulation bodies, like regulator bodies, have already, you know, that work to protect our rights, our health, and like the general safety of workplaces and of, you know, us existing while we're out on the roads or flying in the air, like those things are already fully coming under attack. Trump and his administration have nominated David Keeling to be the head of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA. And Keeling was previously a UPS and then most recently the Amazon safety head, so the head of safety for Amazon. And under his watch, Amazon, you know, was caught manipulating injury data from their warehouse workers around the country to make their warehouses appear safer. And of course, as we've covered on this show extensively, during his watch, even though they were manipulating data, the reality is that there were people being severely injured on the job, nearly injured on the job, and many of them dying on the job, as well as, you know, during that time also reports that drivers, delivery drivers, were being pushed so far, like to meet quotas so far beyond what they could, that they were being forced to pee in bottles while they were still out on the road and things like that. So already the track record of the person who will be in charge of the government body regulating workplace safety has proven to actually fully side with management to the physical harm and sometimes death of the workers.
Yeah,
the place he oversaw.
Yeah, for sure. You know, and we've talked a lot. Obviously, we've talked ad nauseum about Amazon and their kind of horrific safety practices. But I think, you know, we won't be able to touch on every single agency or regulatory body. But I think the through line thread here is that Trump is doing the opposite of draining the swamp, in that he's basically taking lobbyists, what would be the equivalent of a lobbyist, and putting them at the heads of these organizations, whether it be the Department of Education or, in this case, OSHA, right? People who don't believe in the very thing they're about to go regulate.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, of course, we saw it in the first Trump administration, putting the, you know, head of oil, oil executive in charge of, you know, environmental regulations and things like that. But, you know, that was child's play compared to what we're seeing in the second administration already. And that is, you know, just us talking about Trump, the official president himself. When you look at, you know, the shadow president, or maybe, you know, the true president at this moment, you know, Elon Musk, we're seeing even more attacks on regulatory bodies. And a lot of those seem to be coming less from just sort of economic standpoints or ideological standpoints. And, you know, a lot of them seem to be coming from a place of personal vengeance or retribution. Yeah. On the part of Elon, specifically talking about places like the FAA, where the head of the FAA was basically forced out in the first week of the Trump administration by Elon Musk. And the FAA famously has come down hard on Musk's SpaceX company for safety and other types of like violations that they oversee. And of course, what's the first thing he does? He takes out the head of that company, that regulatory body. Mm-hmm. We're also seeing them go after Labor Department. You know, Musk has, you know, not violently, but very, very seriously put down workplace union drives at his company Tesla. And the Labor Department, the NLRB, has sided with the workers there in the past. And so, of course, that is a major target for someone like him. And, you know, we're also seeing the gutting of the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, a agency that has, under the previous administration, under the Biden administration, been incredibly effective at trying to regulate major companies and to try and protect consumers and you know, working people in this country, to the detriment of people like Elon Musk. And of course, that was a major target right away. We will miss you, Lena Khan, of course.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like, you know, if your agency had any direct impact or you know, just attempted to regulate an industry in which Elon Musk plays in the private sector, then you're going to show up on this list, right? It's a list of all of his most famous kind of upsetting grievances with the government.
Yeah, and you know, we're seeing the direct results. It's not even like this was a, you know, these problems were laid and then later on the results of them came. I mean, within the first month of the Trump administration, after the head of the FAA was forced out by Elon, we've seen, I think it's like 7 major plane crash or near crash incidents, which is far beyond anything we've seen in this country in the last like 2 decades. So there is a direct correlation. There has to be a direct correlation there between getting rid of the head of the agency tasked with maintaining safety of plane travel and increased incidents within plane travel. Like, that, there is no way those are unrelated. And, you know, on top of that, it's not just these agencies, but it's also federal workers themselves that are under assault from this new administration. Federal workers are essentially like the canaries in the coal mine. The assault on those workers is often what gets done first. They also are the largest unionized sector of the workforce in this country. An assault on federal workers is really just a harbinger of what's to come for working Americans across the board. On day one, the Trump administration issued executive orders impacting the federal workforce. One of them reinstated Schedule F, which upends longstanding job protections for federal career employees and makes it easier to fire them for any reason. So basically no cause firings. The first day, Trump also signed an executive order that rescinded an executive order that was signed by President Biden in January of 2021. So basically when he first took office. And that executive order, which is EO 14003, that stated the federal government should serve as a model employer, and that rebuilding the career federal workforce and encouraging union organizing and collective bargaining are policies of the United States. So that is now gone. That was put in place. That was the directive of the Biden administration, and that is now completely gone from the federal government. That executive order also revoked. The one that Biden signed had also revoked an executive order that was created by the first Trump administration, which then made it easier to fire federal workers in jobs that are normally apolitical and therefore have civil service protections. So again, an issue that Trump created, Biden had then nullified by signing a new executive order, and Trump has now rescinded that. So it is again now under the new administration easier to fire federal workers in jobs that are normally apolitical. And finally, this executive order that was rescinded also revoked a series of executive orders and presidential memorandum by the first Trump administration that were issued during his first term that limited the rights of federal workers to collectively bargain and made it easier to fire those federal workers by removing due process and collective bargaining agreement protections. So all of that is back in play now. So collective bargaining is under attack for federal workers, and it certainly is not long for it to be under attack for the general workforce in this country as well. They, along with all that, they also instituted a federal hiring freeze and mandated federal workers return to in-person work 5 days a week, which if you think about it is really just a way, because there's a lot of federal workers who had never had to be in person 5 days a week. And so it really was a ploy to force a lot of workers out, to force them into like early retirement. And, you know, just to double down on that, they also offered buyouts for federal workers. They referred to them as, quote, deferred resignation. But that happened right away. And the White House claims that 75,000 workers have already accepted their deferred resignations so far to this point, which is basically just a hollowing out of the federal workforce. And, you know, officially, according to a spokesperson, you know, spokespeople for the administration, all of the president's broader efforts to, you know, quote, restructure and streamline the federal government are to better serve the American people at the highest possible standard. But, you know, along with that, the Trump administration is essentially seeking to cut 10% of the federal workforce overall. Like, that is their stated goal at this point. And, you know, just for context, the federal government employs more than 2 million workers, and their total compensation makes up about 6.6% of the overall budget.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you hear the term thrown around a lot that, you know, a lot of people want the government to be run like a business. Yeah. And so I think Elon and Trump are showing you how they like to run businesses. And that is, right, that you're kind of targeting things that they view as, like, quote unquote, you know, waste or fraud or something like that. When at the end of the day, a government, you know, while seemingly looking like a large, a very, very large business, it's not always directly the same, right? Yeah. And, you know, the outcomes aren't always tied to ROI or things that I think, you know, someone like Elon is probably focused on or things like that. And so, you know, if this is what they do to federal workers, I think you can hunt, which are the ones they directly control, this is what they want to be happening to other workers, right? They just can't control enough of the system to do such. So, to your point, the canary in the coal mine, I think, is a great analogy, because this is what they would, they're essentially acting like how they want to see the rest of the economy act.
Yeah, because I mean, as the president, you can't directly impact the private sector, right? Like, you know, you can't force companies to do anything, but what you can do is enact policies within the federal government that then could sort of set the table or set the standard for the rest of the economy in the way that, like, you know, the Democratic administration could raise the federal minimum wage and then basically do that as an encouraging step towards the minimum wage for federal workers, and then do that as a way to encourage private sector companies to also raise their, you know, their base wages, or to encourage Congress to raise the federal minimum wage.
Yeah.
This is, you know, the same type of approach, just from the other direction,
yeah,
making things worse for workers, of course.
Yeah. And I think, too, you know, we're not going to go into the tactical ways in which, you know, the last decade has seen a huge rise in the use of executive orders by, like, yes, both parties. But I think, you know, the Washington Post put out a really nice video about, like, what an executive order is, if people want to go check that out. And I think it's important to understand that, you know, I think both sides have actually been using executive orders in ways that maybe they weren't really intended to. But I think it's important to be really clear that you can't change laws with executive orders. It's about the interpretation of existing laws. And I think that the way in which Trump is using executive orders so far in this second term is not following the idea of what an executive order is.
Right. And yeah, a lot of it comes down to, like, a reliance on executive orders, because there's less ability to get things passed through Congress because of gridlock there. But
yeah,
you know, if that's one thing, you know, for a president, like, that's probably accounts for a lot of the rise in it. But, you know, a lot of what Trump is doing is because if this were presented for a vote, a lot of things he's pushing for, it probably would not pass. So therefore he's going through the executive order route instead.
Yeah. And he's kind of hoping that people just allow him to do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've seen people pushing back, you know, and I definitely agree with the sentiment out there in the world that, you know, we want the Democratic Party to be doing more, yeah, but also when you see these lawsuits happening, that is right. That is the Democratic engine kind of working to stop some of these things.
Yeah.
Now, for example, though, you know, some of his executive orders have been blocked by district court judges,
right,
and then the corresponding agencies, again, because he's installed his own people there, just aren't listening.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that I don't know enough politically or constitutionally to understand what happens there, but, you know, you could argue that they're basically ignoring the courts. So, you know, it remains to be seen what happens in a situation like that.
Yeah. And it's scary to think, too, that, like, okay, so a federal court blocks the executive order or the mandate, and then the agency basically continues doing the thing and ignores the court ruling. So then maybe it's appealed to a higher court. Eventually it's appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court, which we know is basically fully seated by, mm-hmm, by Trump appointees and people who, you know, maybe would not always along every single line fall on the side of the administration, but have proven, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt that they do lean heavy conservative and tend to favor,
yeah,
the points of view that are being brought forth by the Trump administration.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, regardless of, you know, whether he's using executive orders or not legally, the reality is that right now it's hurting working class people, it's hurting labor,
yeah,
and it's hurting, like, Americans,
right?
Right. And so, you know, regardless of, you know, however it plays out in the actual, like, like, government workings, it's hurting people now, right?
Yeah. And that, I mean, that's the big picture of it, is that, like, the pain is kind of the point, it seems like. You know, there's a lot of rhetoric that is being put forth by Trump and the people around him that the entire project, the MAGA project, is to make America great again. It is to restore democracy, and it is to, you know, save this country, or whatever it is that they say.
Yeah.
But none of that is being borne out in the on the ground results of what they're doing. And it doesn't really point to a larger vision of a saved America as much as it points to a vision of a looted America, or America that works for, like, is run by and works for exclusively the benefit of the people at the very top of the system. And when you look at it from, you know, from that perspective, it does seem like all of these do follow a plan. It's just a plan that is very, very scary to most Americans.
Yeah.
And should be far scarier than it seems to be at this point. So, you know, along with all of that, and we mentioned, you know, that there was all these executive orders put down, but on top of that, there's also a hiring freeze and a direct purging of workers, you know, like purging of the workforce, which is kind of being led in large part by the what used to be the U.S. Digital Service, but is now the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, which of course is the pet project of Elon Musk. And he is, you know, so a lot of the processes are being overseen by the people that he's hired to do the work, who mostly range from age 19 to 25 and have zero previous government experience or not a lot of experience with the systems that the, you know, the digital systems that the government is using. And so this purge is being done quickly, but it's also being kind of done haphazardly, and it's leading to a lot of messy fallout that these agencies and the career workers are having to deal with, the fallout of, including, you know, a lot of people being fired and then unfired, having to be rehired back because it wasn't, you know, the right people were not fired, or whatever, you know, the issue might be. And so it's not surprising that, you know, if you have someone who comes in, especially someone from like the tech world, who comes in saying, we're going to run the government like a business, we're going to move fast and break things, and whatever, you know, that the ethos of startup culture is, when you apply that to a non-business organization, a government organization that is not designed to move fast and break things, but is rather designed to be stable and methodical
and get it right.
Exactly.
Or attempt to get it right.
Right. Yeah. And so when you apply all of those tech world principles, business world principles to the workings of government, it is not surprising that we're seeing planes fall out of the sky. It's not surprising that we're seeing workers being fired and rehired in the same day, because things are not being done methodically or thoughtfully, or as you said, you know, like properly.
Yeah. Well, and to be honest, I mean, it's what the American people voted for, right? In that we just watch him do this with Twitter, right?
Right.
He made so many cuts to the program, you know, the amount of anti-Semitism, the amount of like, you know, basically just kind of vitriol on the website went up. And that's because he got rid of all of these different safety committees and things like that. So, you know, it's hard to argue that, you know, creating a safe environment for people is something in his forte, when he just bought one of the largest public square platforms in existence and then did the exact opposite of that.
Essentially made it a gathering place for Nazis.
Yeah.
For lack of a better term, there are just a lot of open Nazi accounts on there now. That's cool. But, you know, so along with all of this and the firing of all these workers and like what the vision or the long-term plan is, you know, when you fire this many workers all at once, and you purge 75,000, you purge 10% of the federal workforce, they make up a sizable portion of the economy, and those dollars, you know, that they would be making and therefore spending no longer get made and therefore no longer get spent within our economy.
Yeah, and I think it's a huge point that you don't see brought up a lot, is like, and obviously, right, if a job doesn't make sense, it doesn't make sense. And I think on its face, you know, I'm not against getting rid of fraud and waste, right? But if it's used in a self-retribution or kind of like self-motivated manner, and it's seemingly is, you know, completely biased in its where it's targeting, then at that point you're eliminating jobs just to eliminate them. And this is a gigantic amount of people that spend a whole lot of money in the economy. And so it will be felt. It'll 100% be felt.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, it's not only are we losing tax base, we're losing money coming into the economy, but also these agencies that are, a lot of them, there to administer public services or regulate for safety and health and other things that keep the American people safe or healthy or functioning or providing, getting services. We're losing institutional knowledge from a lot of these people who are career workers in these fields and went to school and got trained and got advanced degrees, have on the job experience. You're losing that institutional knowledge. And what you're replacing it with is, and very similar to what you said, like how Twitter worked when Trump took over, you're replacing it with people who have no experience and are way too young to understand the consequences of what they're doing in a lot of cases. And so you're basically replacing people, institutional knowledge, with no knowledge and a hollow, you know, veneer.
Yeah, which again, on its face, doesn't isn't a negative thing, but when it's in this context of this move fast, break things, you know, this is just not right. When you're moving fast and you're breaking things on Twitter, people can't post about what's going on with them. If you're moving fast and you're breaking things, kids don't get their lunches.
Yeah.
Right. People don't get their, you know, funding gets cut off to even local things that affect more smaller communities. Yeah. Right. You know, all of these massive implications. And so it's not, the two things are not the same.
Yeah. Yeah. You move fast and break things with the FAA, you all of a sudden have air traffic control towers that are unmanned and airports without, you know, controllers there. But yeah, like there is something admirable, or at least nothing wrong with the concept, devoid of ideology, of trying to reduce waste and fraud and abuse within, you know, government budgets, of course. Mm-hmm. But it's very clear that it's not being directed evenly, and it's not being directed at the place where likely most of this is actually taking place. It's being directed at the places that are the most essential to keeping working and middle class people provided for in this country. It's going after jobs, and it's going after services for people, and it's not looking at massive Pentagon contracts. It's not looking at SpaceX contracts. It's not looking at abuse on that end of things, or like, you know, reducing the taxation levels for billionaires. It's looking at how can we cut school lunches and things like that, as you said. And so, yeah, again, that concept is not bad, but the way it is being applied is horrific. And it's very clearly meant for an end goal of reducing the public sphere to the point at which the government does not provide anything for the people of this country, like working people at all. And it only works to further enrich the already rich.
Yep. The last thing today that we want to call out is just kind of some cuts to public education as well as some of the rhetoric around immigration and how it's going to affect kind of, you know, not only the working class, but also, right, like our economy and its success, right? And I think, you know, it's not always bad to be thinking about the economy first, because really it affects the quality of life and, you know, how people live within the country.
Yeah.
So, you know, according to the U.S. Census Bureau in 2021, public schools made up about 82% of all students in America. And with birth rates consistently dropping, less and less children are being born, which means we actually need to be more effective at educating each child in order to make sure the country continues to function properly. Basically, at the Trump in the first few days of his administration, Trump froze billions of dollars of federal grant funding to public schools, which caused gigantic panic and anxiety in educators across the country. A district court judge in Washington actually blocked the order. However, many of the sub-agencies have continued to suspend funding. And so there's a lot of confusion. And, you know, educators, superintendents are unsure what their budgets are going to be and are having to take action kind of like during a school year. I think personally that COVID taught us many, many things, obviously, but one of the largest is how disruption to education has lifelong impacts on the children who are affected. And not only that, but I think it remains to be seen how it's going to affect the economy when many of the children start entering the workforce that were affected by COVID.
Yeah,
and so these freezes also tend to not only are they kind of getting at what I'm talking about here, they're going to affect the outcomes and the success rates of children in the educational system. But the freeze also tends to disproportionately affect lower income school districts, as federal funding on average makes up more of their budget. Becky Pringle, who is the president of the National Educators Association, or the NEA, blasted these funding freezes in an interview with ABC, saying, quote, "This is a move straight from the extreme Project 2025 playbook and will have an immediate and devastating impact on millions," end quote. She also went out of her way to remind people that many children around the country rely on their public schools for lunches, either provided for free or at a subsidized rate. We're not going to go into details here on it, obviously, but there are so many studies linking the nutrition of young learners to their success in the classroom. And even slight disruptions, like I mentioned, can stack up and create an environment where they can't catch up.
Yeah.
And then finally, right, you know, to bring immigration into all of this, you know, I think the Trump administration seems to be incredibly focused on construction and manufacturing jobs, but they seem perfectly fine cutting ties with skilled foreign labor, which I think most economists would tell you is a massive mistake, especially in the STEM fields, which are greatly needed to move our economy forwards, especially as we move towards more like software services and intellectual property being the primary drivers of the economy. His rhetoric around H visas for workers and F visas for students is pretty scary when you consider how badly the economy needs educated workers. Under the last Trump administration, processing times for work permits rose steadily until the pandemic, which it only dropped because there were less applicants. And so they were able to basically get through the backload. In the case of H visas, right, which are for students, educating people here and then kicking them out by not giving them H visas, right? Or sorry, in the case of H visas, which again are for working, educating people here with an F visa and then kicking them out to go benefit another country's economy is a pretty laughable decision that will have massive implications kind of in the long run. And, you know, automation, I don't think, can replace all of these things and these people. So I think in the aggregate, these attacks on kind of public education are going to just hurt the economy and in turn hurt the country.
Yeah. I mean, it seems pretty clear that, like, if you make it harder to keep people who come to this country to learn, to get higher education, to keep them here, so instead we leak those people back to, you know, other countries or the countries they came from, we aren't retaining that workforce. So that's the one end of the immigration spectrum. And on the other end, if you are threatening to deport the people who are doing the physical labor of building a lot of the construction projects in this country that you want to have more manufacturing, more construction, mm-hmm. and also the people doing a lot of the agriculture work, you're going to see on both ends of the policies that he's putting in place, you're going to see impacts directly to the economy in this country and to the things that we are able to access as like consumers here as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is. The larger picture of what we're seeing here is basically, I think, very